This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Puppy's First Steps, starts with some sobering information. Each year, some 13 million American households adopt a dog. The next year, half of those households surrender those dogs to shelters and pounds where most of them are put to sleep. The book offers information that might prevent some of these misguided adoptions. It advises readers how to choose a puppy that's right for them and how to raise it once they take it home. My guest Nicholas Dodman edited the book. He's an animal behaviorist at Tufts University's School of Veterinary Medicine. All the contributors to the book are on the faculty. Dodman's other books include The Dog Who Loved Too Much and Dogs Behaving Badly. Dr. Dodman, welcome back to Fresh Air. You recommend when choosing a dog to do something called temperament testing. What is it?
Temperament testing has been around for a long time, and scientists have always sort of turned their nose up at it and said, we're not sure that any decent studies have been done to show that it actually predicts anything. And to some extent, you can imagine it's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you take a dog that you temperament test and you think that it's going to be rather pushy when it grows up, you know, if you take that piece of information and you place that dog with a person who's a strict owner, and the dog doesn't get pushy, then you say, well, good, I've done the right kind of placement. And if it does get pushy, you say, oh, good, my temperament testing was right. So you can't lose either way.
Can you describe how temperament testing works?
So essentially, there's a number of different ways of doing it. And some of the classical ways are, for example, if you take a little puppy that's sort of, 7 or 8 or 9 weeks old, and you lift it up underneath the armpits and have it hanging there like a piece of spaghetti. If it hangs limp, supposedly that is a more submissive dog. And if it struggles to get free and sort of kicks and wriggles, that predicts a rather willful dog that could turn into a problem child if not properly, honed in. Another test is that you take a puppy and you put it on its back and cradle it in your arms and lay a hand on its chest and look right into its eyes. And if it accepts that without complaining, again, that's a sign of, a more deferent pup, whereas the wriggling, struggling is the more wayward child who's going to need a stricter hand.
You have some interesting recommendations when you're taking home a puppy, what to do. Like, you have a whole set of recommendations of what to do in the car ride, taking home the puppy for the first time. Why is the car ride really important?
Well, treating a puppy in a very gentle and non-threatening manner is important right from the get-go. A friend of mine who's a little bit more extreme than me would say that, kindness and training begins when the puppy's in the mum's uterus. I think that's a little bit extreme. But certainly when the puppy's eyes and ears first open, the goal is to expose them to all kinds of shapes and sizes and things and people in a very kind and benevolent way, non-threatening. And the other side of that penny is to protect them from anything that might be, aversive. And the car ride is just one of a string of things that could be a rude awakening. So if you take an extreme example, even worse than a car ride, if you're talking about a puppy mill dog who ends up either on a train or a plane, separated from its mother, with all kinds of noises and things that go bump in the day, falling around from side to side with the rocking and the rolling, sometimes, with other dogs transported with it don't even arrive alive. I mean, that ride can have a permanent effect, because a puppy is a sort of an indelible learning sponge at that stage. So, coming down to the more gentle experience of the car ride, we think it's very important that the transition, which is a very important transition from mum, the bitch, to the owner, is done smoothly, with minimal trauma, and the car ride is the link between the breeder's place and your home, and it should be done in a very nurturing way. So we have photographs in the book of people coddling and carrying and protecting from the elements the puppy as it's carried to the car. Of course, no puppy should ride in the front seat for the same reasons children shouldn't ride in the front seat, airbags exploding at 200 miles an hour. You need one person in the back who can give undivided attention to that puppy, who, if it's small, can, you know, nurture it and coddle it and try and make the experience as pleasant as possible, while the driver makes sure that they take the, you know, the least noisy, least bumpy, least stressful route and drives, you know, at a respectable rate. So we're trying to facilitate it almost effortlessly. We're trying to remove the tablecloth from under the crockery without having any spillage, so that the puppy arrives there unruffled. Otherwise, you end up with dogs that we sometimes see down the road that have, you know, fear of car travel, and they shiver and they shake and they salivate, and it's just a mess. And now we have to correct that. It's far better to avoid it up front.
One of the difficult things about getting a puppy is training the puppy to do his or her business outside. And you have, I think, some very good suggestions for that. Would you run through, like, your basics of how to house train a puppy?
Sure. You know, I think this is a pretty simple exercise, and this is one thing. I mean, it is said that 10%, I've even heard an estimate of 20% of behavior problems presented to vets include, you know, some sort of failure of the puppy to respect the home and urinating or defecating inside. And it needn't be like that. And I think, you know, for us, you know, what success rate would we have with that problem? It's 100%. But you don't even need to be there. If you adopt a 9-week-old puppy, some breeders will say that the puppy is, you know, half-trained or trained. It's possible to have some training going on even at that age. But what you do is, you know, if that's the case, you have realistic expectations that, first of all, a little puppy can't hold its urine for a huge amount of time. It's usually considered to be, you know, the age in months plus one. So a 4-month-old puppy can maybe hold it for 5 hours. You need to put that into your equation when working. But essentially, the program involves, and we sort of skirt around paper training. We don't like that in-home training. It's kind of training in the wrong direction. So we start right from the get-go training them to go outside. And the three aspects are, number one, find a place that is sort of quiet and appropriate for the pup to go, that's reasonably close and convenient for you. So you've identified the bathroom area. Take the pup out and, you know, use a lead if you have to, and keep it confined in that area and stay with it until it has a successful mission. If you don't, after 15 minutes, if it wasn't successful, you bring the puppy back inside and you confine it in some way, perhaps behind a kitty gate in a recess off the kitchen, or another type is called umbilical cord training, where you tie it to your belt on a lead, and 15 minutes later you take it out again. So you're, first of all, ensuring that it does go in the right place, and secondly, you're assuring that it doesn't go in the wrong place, because a puppy will not go in a place it's confined.
So if a puppy can only hold its urine for, say, 3 or 4 or 5 hours, by your standards, that means you're waking up in the middle of the night to take the puppy out.
Yeah, that's true, but it's not for a long time. You know, there's lots of parents of very young children realize there's going to be some, you know, nocturnal disturbances for several months or even a year or more. With a puppy, it's much less long than that. But it is important, if you want to avoid accidents, to have the puppy on a regular schedule. And that may involve initially, you know, setting your alarm and getting up in the night. But it's also important to know that during the evening time, when the puppy's sort of sleeping, metabolism slows down, urine production slows down. So you can sometimes get a longer spell at night, but you still may have to set your alarm at, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning and get up for a while until you can train him to hold it through the night.
My guest is animal behaviorist Nicholas Dodman. He edited the new book, Puppy's First Steps. What do you think of pit bulls? Some people just love their pit bull dogs and think their pit bull dogs are actually kind of sweet, even though they have a reputation for being fighters. And of course, other people have pit bulls because they want to fight them. They want to engage in dog fights with the pit bulls. And in some states now, pit bulls are illegal. And I've heard that in some states, pit bulls are actually confiscated by the authorities if they're found. What are your thoughts about pit bulls?
Well, I think the old adage, there's no such thing as a bad dog, a bad owner, you know, has some truth to it. So if you take, you know, unscrupulous people who, you know, torture and torment pit bulls to make them into these, you know, sort of mean biting machines, I mean, that's a travesty. And, you know, the dog has been really abused in terms of its upbringing. a more responsible owner, preferably, I would say, not a novice owner, but someone who knows what they're doing, can take a pit bull or that type of dog and can raise it with kid gloves to be, you know, a gentle giant. And they have, you know, tremendous loyalty. They've got a lot of personality. But I think you always have to bear in mind that they do have a very powerful bite, you know, should they ever be so stimulated to use it. And they also have very high prey drive, so things that move, you know, squirrels sort of fair enough, but sometimes it's, you know, kids on bicycles. I mean, they can end up by chasing them and kids running. So you just have to know what you've got, you know, keep your eye on the ball. And, you know, that said, as a responsible pet owner can have a very nice and rewarding relationship with a pit bull terrier.
Are there dogs that you would recommend for people who live in cities, and particularly who live in, like, you know, apartments in cities?
Well, for the city dwellers, I mean, oftentimes they get it wrong in the sense that they'll say, well, I've got a tiny apartment, and so what I'm going to do is get a tiny dog. And then they go and get, you know, something from the terrier group, like a Jack Russell Terrier, or now called Parsons Russell Terrier. And those guys, they're like on rocket fuel. I mean, they just zoom around the place. They need a tremendous amount of energy and containment. So that's the wrong dog for an apartment. But on the other hand, they say, well, I really shouldn't get a great big dog, you know, like a Pyrenees or something, because, you know, they're too big for a small apartment. But the fact is that a lot of those larger dogs will kind of lie around all day, and they're not particularly, they don't have super high energy, you know, like I say, I like the Parsons Russell Terrier. So, you know, you just need to think. You don't need a particularly high-energy dog. You don't need a dog that was bred to, like a Dalmatian, run along by the side of carriages for miles and miles all day. You know, other dogs that were bred to, you know, drag sleds across the Arctic wastes or join in the Iditarod race. You just need a sort of, you know, four-on-the-floor dog who's a kind of low-profile character and possibly something in the larger direction.
You said that 9 out of 10 dogs whose owners bring the dogs to your clinic have been through the Hard Knocks school of training in their puppy classes, punishment-based tactics. What kind of tactics are you talking about there that you disapprove of?
Well, this becomes a very contentious, you know, issue. But you know, we don't think that it is necessary to use physical punishment, especially with a pup, but also with you know, a juvenile or even adult dog. We just think that punishment is not necessary, that it is, you know, a legacy from past methods of training, and that there are plenty of other ways. Instead of that, it's not that we don't use any punishment at all. We do. Some people say, oh, they're soft, you know, they don't use punishment. Yes, we do. We use negative punishment, the same as you might do for a child, so that, you know, if you do not do this, then you will not get that. So it's withholding. In doing that, you can emphasize your leadership and have a respectful pup who will follow directions. You know, to be a leader, you don't have to coerce. You know, I think you can lead sort of by example and by kind of creating a vacuum into which the dog must flow if it knows what's good for it and if it wants to get the things that maybe currently it takes for granted. So we deal with leadership, and you can be a leader like you hope most human beings are leaders without being physically abusive. You know, all successful people, you know, high up politicians or executives in veterinary school do not need to go around using physical force to get their way.
How many dogs do you have?
I have no dogs at home. I have a house full of animals, but some of them are incompatible. There's a couple of reasons that we don't have a dog at home right now, and one of them is that we both work, so there's not going to be people home, and we think dogs should, they should either have two dogs or you should be home with your dog. And at the moment I have two horses, a rat, a bunch of fish, three parakeets, a green Amazon parrot, and a couple of horses. So, you know, and they're not actually in the house, the horses. But when we go to sleep at night, there's four adults in the house, my wife, myself, and a couple of children still at home. but there's about 12 hearts beating under our roof, so I'm surrounded by pets, you know. I feel like Dr. Doolittle, but no dog at the moment.
Just one more thing. Why do you have a rat?
Actually, it started out with the children. It started out with my wife, because my wife had started a PhD program in Boston, and because she's also a vet, and because of the way that the animals were treated, she decided that she would not continue with the PhD. And as she exited, she smuggled out a couple of rats. I think one was called Matilda.
These were research rats?
Research rats, and they became her very best friends, and they would come and greet her at the door when she came back and squeak with excitement. They're totally non-aggressive. She found them very cuddly. They'd run up and down on her bed and sleep with her, and they knew their names, and very, very social pets. And so later, when the children said, we might like to get a pair of rats, we looked at each other and lit up and said, let's do it. So we got the rats, and sure enough, they are terrific little pets, very intelligent, sensitive, and it's hard to believe. I saw something on the news the other day about how there's a group who is trying to promote them as pets, and it's true, they're very smart and very affectionate pets.
Do they live in a cage?
They have to live in a cage. Well, there's one left. One actually got so old it ended up with cancer, and we had to put it to sleep a few weeks back. But they live in this very large cage. I mean, it's with all kinds of hidey holes and burrowing things. But they come out and play. So we'd be sitting watching TV, and the rat's walking up and down on the back of the couch and jumps onto somebody's shoulder and then onto somebody's lap and then goes behind you and behind a cushion and pops out again. But they have to basically live because they chew. So they'd chew through wires, they'd chew through wood, and, for our own protection as well as the rat's own protection, we have to, use the cage. It's the same with the parrot, that the parrot, is essentially free. It flies around this sort of large open-plan house and lands on windowsills and stuff. But when we're out, we can't leave the parrot out. It would destroy the house. They're very chewy things. In fact, I know a parrot called Chewy.
Well, Dr. Dodman, thank you for talking with us. Great to talk with you.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Terry. I appreciate the opportunity to come back and talk with you again.
Nicholas Dodman edited the new book, Puppy's First Steps. He's on the faculty of Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine, as are all the contributors to the book.